On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass student Maura Murray drove from her dorm in Amherst, Massachusetts to the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., Maura spun out her 1996 Saturn on a hairpin turn on Route 112 in North Haverhill. There has never been a credible sighting of Maura since.
Maura is 5'7" tall. She weighs 120 pounds, and she has brown hair and hazel eyes.
If you have any information regarding Maura's disappearance, please submit it to us, the Murray family, through their Facebook page, or the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
This is Missing Maura Murray. Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Studios in Wormtown. Lance, how are you today?
Doing really well. Got a great sleep last night. How are you today?
I'm doing well, too. And Lance, this episode that we're going to bring our fine audience today was recorded in the state of New Hampshire at the University of New Hampshire. We were asked to sort of give a guest lecture, or at least sit in on a forensic anthropology class and discuss the Maura Murray case.
Yeah, it was a little bit intimidating at first, so we got the invitation from our friend Amy, who invited us to talk to her students. And at first, I was thinking it was going to be like you see in the movies where those, you know, multi-tiered rooms, and then there's the desk down at the bottom, and you basically need like binoculars to see the professor. So that's what was going on in my head when I was driving to Durham, New Hampshire. Beautiful town, by the way. Driving to Durham, New Hampshire, found the parking lot, went in, and realized that this is a regular classroom. These are regular kids, and Amy is a super down to earth person. Made it really easy. Really smart kids. Really smart professor. And they were really interested in not only Maura's case, but our journey and also what to do moving forward. They had a list of questions that were incredible that we could have gone on for hours with.
Yeah, and each student is researching their own case, their own cold case, and trying to find some information on it and things like that. So I think it's a really interesting lesson, I guess, in a course. It's a forensic anthropology course taught by Amy Michael. And Lance, old friend, Robert Eckstein was there as well. Bobby from episode, I think it was 11 of this very podcast, where we spoke with Bobby Eckstein of UNH, who is a professor of forensic psychology. And that was so long ago. And this was the first time we ever met him.
I know. He popped in. Well, first, we were told by Amy that he was there and he was interested in meeting us. So to add to the anxiety, we were about to meet Bobby Eckstein as well. So that was a little bit of a little nerve-wracking because he was really intimidating when we interviewed him on the show, not because he's an intimidating person by nature, just because he's very, very smart. And I just don't react well to incredibly smart people. I think I try to make stuff up. But
that's why you're so weird around me.
Yeah, exactly. But joking aside, he did pop in and he couldn't be more nice. I mean, he's an incredibly gracious person. He actually kind of apologized for his interview with us on the early episode of Missing Maura Murray. He said that he was operating off of very preliminary facts. He did a lot of research about Maura's case, but what's happened since then has made him rethink some of the things he said. Not exactly, you know, he would never like take things back, but he's gone on the journey with us. And he said, you know, some of the things that I said in the past, like I've rethought, which I think is amazing and super humbling that someone like him would continue to follow this case, our journey, the things that come up on this show, and then apply it to what he said previously. I think that's incredibly humbling, and I don't really know how to take it other than, you know, a huge thank you to him for taking us that seriously.
Yeah, it was very cool to meet him finally and to hang out with him and Amy and all the students, Lance. And so this episode today is audio from that classroom, that guest lecture, I guess you'd call it.
I think one of the bigger takeaways, like we said earlier, is to listen to the questions that the students had. they were put up on the overhead projector, so the students didn't exactly ask them in real time. Amy had taken the questions and put them up there, and we answered them as part of our lecture or dialogue with them. Afterward, they came up and we had some conversations with them. Some of them are connected to Morris Case just by location, by proxy, and that was really interesting as well. But the questions that they had during the lecture were very applicable to the things that we get on an everyday basis, and then there were some surprises in there as well.
Yeah, and so some of the audio is Amy and Bobby, the professors, speaking. You hear very little from the students, but you will hear a little bit of Amy and a little bit of Bobby, and it's not great audio, their angle, because basically our recorder was across the room from them. And so we have mics, so we, you and I, Lance, sound good, you have to, I don't know if it's a struggle, it's a change in audio when they talk, so just bear with it, but you can understand them, and you can follow the conversation.
And one more thing, we do have a growing network, Tim, Crawlspace Media. You can check out all of our shows, all of those who have joined the family at crawlspace-media.com. They're all fascinating shows. They run the gamut, and you will not be disappointed with any one of them. That is a Crawlspace guarantee. So check that out at crawlspace-media.com.
The first clip, we discuss missing white woman syndrome.
Yeah, that question came up very early on when we started working on Morris Case back, a couple of years ago, where people would say that this is a missing white woman syndrome because of Morris' appearance. She was presented as the all-American girl. So to get that one with these kids on that day and realize that that was still a thing that was out there just shows like the scale that this case has. Even though we feel like we've answered that numerous times, people just getting into this case are just rediscovering it.
We had discussed on Tuesday in class a couple things. Victim discounting, something called the missing white woman syndrome. And I think this is a perfect example of missing white woman syndrome, right? There's so much press about Morris Case. And you even spoke to Lance in the first class about, she's young, she's pretty. Like, this is kind of like a sexy story to tell. If you want to weigh in on, why this case in particular, was it because of like the geographic area she was missing in kind of this rural remote space there? We sort of like city dwellers have kind of like that's a little spooky for us anyway, but then sex, race, class, status, anything you want to weigh in on, what made this case so popular? Why did so many people around the internet world kind of get drawn into it?
Yeah, I think, in my opinion, it's definitely a big combination of factors. All this is true, missing white woman syndrome, and there is a thing out there if you look into missing persons cases. The most popular ones are young women, typically white, typically of a certain class or status, I guess. But that was all kind of happening with Maura Murray's case before we ever got involved. We didn't really make the choice to move that forward, but that definitely happened because we were a part of it.
And it happened because you see the picture of her here, and coming in here today, I think I saw like half a dozen or a dozen Maura Murrays as I came in here today, because it's the All-American Girl, and they set this up as the All-American Girl just to break it down, just to say that it's the All-American Girl, or so you thought. But she was an alcoholic, and she was promiscuous, and she was this and this. Alternatively, we have Breonna Maitland, who is just as an all-American girl as Maura Murray, but she actually had a drug problem.
And she was a few years younger, too. She was 17.
Yeah, and she actually was from a bad neighborhood and had a group of people that were bad influences, but that's already there. You don't have to dig, and it doesn't have to spoil the image of the all-American girl. She's already been damaged. So that's why her case doesn't get as much coverage as Maura Murray's case, because people love learning the secrets. They love the dirty laundry. And you could take the all-American girl from the all-American family, the Irish family from South Shore, Massachusetts, and you have to make them into something they're not.
I also think the circumstances of Maura's disappearance play a role, too, because she seemingly vanished out of nowhere, like into thin air. And there are cases like this, just Google missing persons and you'll find ones like this. Brianna Maitland is, I would say, a little bit different because it seemed like she was kind of pulled from the car. So that seems like an aggressive move, the way her car was left. But Maura, by all accounts, got into a single car accident and was there by herself and vanished. There are other cases like, I don't know if you guys remember Molly Tibbetts from Iowa from, I think it was earlier this year. Oh, and that was very much like this case on the surface when it was like, oh, this woman from Iowa, the middle of Iowa or the middle of nowhere, basically, or actually, I guess she was in a college town, but she had a boyfriend and she went running at 10. Well, that sounds weird. Who runs at 10 at night? Well, what about her boyfriend? Where was he? You know, he wasn't following her. And then she goes missing and completely disappears off the face of the earth But then you find out that it was completely random, just completely random. This guy driving down the street or whatever it was. So, yeah, I think that the into thin air thing definitely is terrifying at people's cores, I think.
Yeah, and if there was like a recipe that you could come up with, like a stew that you could make for a missing person, Maura's would be it. You have the pretty face and you have the relatable family and then you have the into thin air. And the more you start peeling back the layers, it doesn't stop. And that is a sort of recipe for what draws people intrinsically to be fascinated with this case and want to get to the core of it.
Yeah, it's a thought experiment.
It's a major thought experiment. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's endless theories when someone vanishes into thin air
but
like that.
Don't you disagree with mine?
Something that struck me is a little off topic, but something that struck me about this case, having and you'll hear from me about other cases that are quite different, is that just the amount of photographs that are available of her online. That says, there's family investment, there's like, you know, she had siblings that carried all this stuff. I mean, I've worked cold cases before where we have to beg extended family members, like, do you think you could go through your basement and like maybe come up with, but we have no antemortem photos, right? And so then you have somebody like Maura, who all I can do is just Google and I come up with 20 straight away. And so it's like all of these things, everything you just talked about, but then just the availability of like her family is clearly invested in what happened to her. And that's just not the case for, and it might not be the case for some of the cool cases you guys are working on too, right? I bet that some of you could not generate 20 photos of your victim or your missing person.
She actually had so many pictures and there was so much out there that didn't have anything to back it up. Like she is gone. But she has this entire like presence right now in the ether, right? There was a moment where I made an offhanded joke about maybe she didn't even exist in the first place. Maybe this is just a digital image that is some weird thought experiment that someone's doing as a prank. It wasn't a real thought. Like, it was just a joke thought in my head, but it is so like aggressive with how much is out there and how much you don't have. What you're left with is nothing, but you have this presence that doesn't, it's like a ghost.
Yeah. Well, and as has been written about before, you know, being like the first case of the social media age, she's like right at that marker where people start to actually have this many digital photographs of them. You know, before 2004, you know, you're like, maybe you would have a digital camera, but it was like one weird little thing that, you know, you're taking like a crazy selfie. But for the most part, I mean, and you're not scanning your hard copy photos. And so like this is what we would expect from more missing persons cases recently, mm-hmm. to have this much photographic evidence.
I think the other thing too, and so many other people have said this, that I really can't think of too many. I can maybe think of one or two like comp cases where the person, where this happened, and it happened in such an interesting way, but it happened so far from their home in a way where there's this entire mystery of what she was doing there in the first place.
Yeah.
So I think as everything you all said is accurate, I think if this occurred 5 miles from the UMass campus, mm-hmm. I think it would be half as interesting to the average person who follows these types of cases. It's and I think the way the case has shifted over the last couple of years, like what you were saying, the different theories, and now I think it seems like there's a little bit more of a consensus that the foul play might have been involved. There haven't really been advancements in the theory of what she was doing there.
Yeah, that's accurate.
What brought her to that?
Yeah. And I think that element to it definitely adds, just purely from a human interest vantage point, it adds such a big piece to this case.
Yeah, I think we have to detach ourselves from where we're at today, where everybody knows where everybody is all the time. And even though it's 2004, it's still, that's 15 years ago. So much has happened in 15 years with just everything that can locate us, you know, from GPS on our phone to just like checking in on Facebook or whatever.
Yeah.
With her, like, it makes sense. She needed to get away. She wanted to take a trip, and she got in her car and had a couple of options. She had a couple of possibilities, and she wasn't like checking in. She just needed to get away.
Yeah, but I think to your point, Bobby, it doesn't really help the sort of horror movie trope that that is the beginning of this story, is she goes somewhere else out of her comfort zone and something bad happens. And there's like 90% of the horror movies out there start like that.
And in this next clip, we're talking about speculations and things about the case and how to sort of train yourself to not get carried away.
Which I think is really important, obviously, in the early stages, because these students have picked a cold case to work on. They have to understand, as a civilian, as a non-law enforcement official, how to approach that without getting, I guess, emotionally attached to it.
First one is, how does one effectively look into this case without either focusing too much on the odd and conspiratorial details or completely ignoring them altogether? Which I think is a really good question for this one in particular.
It is really tough because there are a lot of minute details in this case that you can just create your own theory on, and people have. We've seen it over and over.
Yeah, and it's really just sort of your own technique. If you focus too much on an odd or conspiratorial detail, you will get caught up in some, you know, rabbit holes. Allow yourself to go down them a little bit, and then allow yourself to dismiss them. And but maybe not entirely dismiss them. Keep them on your radar, but just like don't train yourself to be too like closed off on certain theories that or details that don't strike your particular interest. You know, if it doesn't fit your theory, that's the name of the game.
Yeah, try not to create a theory if you can. That is really hard, and I think some people might disagree with that because some people, I think that is their tactic, to kind of come up with a theory and then chase that. But in this case, I think it's best to really try to take that 30,000-foot approach if you can. Like, look at the circumstances of her her disappearance. She was under an immense amount of stress. She drove 3 hours to a rural area. She didn't know anyone. Her phone was out of service. She got into an accident. She hit her head on the windshield. I think me and Lance may have a debate on that, but she might not have been thinking clearly when she got out of her car and maybe accepted a ride from someone or accepted help from someone she shouldn't have or under different circumstances wouldn't have.
I think that kind of goes into the second point here, how are some inconsequential details or red herrings seen as major issues, and how can it be avoided? Again, just assess like the entire scenario. And an example of this is the rag in the tailpipe. We know that there was a rag in the tailpipe, and it is a productive exercise to consider why she would put the rag in the tailpipe. Was it a calling card from her, you know, to tell people that she was okay, but she had left? Or was she actually doing what her dad told her? A lot of the details in this case.
Sorry to interrupt. You jumped to she put the rag in her tailpipe. A lot of people get hung up on someone else put it there and followed her until her car crashed.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what we know to be a fact is that Fred told her to do that, to put the rag in her tailpipe when she was driving that car that was apparently smoking a little bit, had blown a gasket, and she was driving from school to clinicals. And so he did it to hide, or he told her to do that to hide the exhaust so she wouldn't get pulled over. Now, I would say it's too coincidental to say that someone else just put that in her tailpipe after, you know, she had gotten that advice.
So you have that, and you can explore all sorts of, you know, reasons why this rag was in the tailpipe. We have another theory out there that there was no footprints in the snow because she climbed a tree and went branch to branch to avoid putting footprints in the snow. This is an actual thing that was suggested to us. That's one of those details that you should probably avoid because that doesn't sound like a reality-based thing that would happen. given her situation. So yes, you sort of have to use your own judgment given what's presented to you.
However, that's an interesting point though, because the theory actually does work. If you want to run with that, you really can. You could say she climbed a tree and, you know, climbed it all the way out of the area and got a ride somewhere else or something. Like, it actually kind of makes sense. That's why it's a hard one. That's why, and it's memorable too. But it's definitely not true, but it would have gotten her out of the area if she was able to do that.
All that being said, it would not surprise me if that actually happened.
It would definitely surprise me.
I think what I have learned in doing forensic work is that, like, yes, fantastical, mysterious things do happen, but, like, parsimony is your friend, and, like, Occam's razor is, like, your thing to live by, which is, like, the simplest answer is usually the closest to reality.
Yeah, that's definitely not swinging tree to tree.
I used to be very opposed to the Occam's razor because I think we just had so many people emailing us so quickly right away, like, oh, it's Occam's razor, it's Occam's razor. And I don't know if like half the people knew what Occam's razor really was, but now I'm on board with it. Everything that is a perceived mystery in this case, most of it has an answer. The rag in the tailpipe, her dad told her to. Well, okay, we just have to believe her dad. You know, there's many things that that line up to make that work. Faith Westman, who called the police, stated that there was activity at the trunk of the car. Well, that makes sense, that she would go to the trunk of her car and get the rag and put it in the tailpipe. Like, you can make that connection. I mean, you don't have to be 100% married to that, but you can say, oh, well, that sort of is like 1 + 1 = 2. Her dad told her to do that. She was hung up on a snowbank, or her car was disabled. Maybe she thought putting the rag in the tailpipe would give the car some, like, she'd be able to start it or get some oomph to get out of there. And she was seen at the trunk. Okay, that seems reasonable to believe that a rag would be kept in the trunk. So just look at, there's a lot of things in this case. If it does get solved, if it's not by someone who confesses, it will be solved by something that was actually there that just hasn't been untangled yet.
Yeah, and we've actually heard like really professional people talk about the rag and say that they think maybe a killer put it in there, but without knowing the detail that Fred told Maura to do it.
And this next clip, we talk about Maura's car a little bit. We talk about Butch Atwood, the bus driver, and we talk about a little bit about law enforcement protocol when they found a car on the side of the road.
And what's really interesting about our answers, Tim, is I think we're used to going back and forth, and at times it feels like in my head that we were going on and on about something and maybe getting distracted and going down different avenues with it. But that's also important to note, that when you're looking at one detail with this case, especially early on, you do start to go down different avenues, because it's not just simply the rag in the tailpipe. The rag in the tailpipe leads to what police would do with a car on the side of the road in the first place. So this is how I guess you have to compartmentalize these details of the case.
This is a conversation that we have with a lot of people, and we have it internally and we have it with law enforcement. There's no protocol for just a car being abandoned on the side of the road.
Yeah, well, it probably shouldn't have been where it was at Troop F.
Oh, it definitely, my opinion, it definitely should not have been
on the grass
at that point.
Yeah.
After 10 years. And I have the same reaction as you guys.
But to that point, like, I don't know what forensic evidence is really good about that car. You know, like, you can't do DNA swabs or even MVAC tests inside the car and get anything useful whatsoever. The only thing I think you could do is potentially like a accident recreation based on the damage of her car. But even then, the damage has actually been added to since the accident due to being moved around a bit. So I actually think the car has no value pretty much right now.
Yeah, it pretty much has no value. I don't even know if it had value in the beginning because the accident. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the accident reconstruction and did the snowbank actually make make these dents? Does that mean that someone like ran her off the road? Well, we don't have an account of that. Again, if you look at everything that's just there, all the statements, no one says, I heard a car hit another car. No, they said they hit a thud and they heard like an engine revving.
Yep.
And which is all in line with a single car accident. There was no metal on metal. There was no, like, I heard a car speed away. Butch came up pretty shortly thereafter. Maura had talked to him. And this goes to, like, if Butch was actually a suspect, if he was responsible for it, do you think that he might say, yeah, I saw a car speed away? But that didn't happen. He had the exact account, as far as his memory could recollect, that with Maura, that in that interaction with Maura, she never said that someone ran her off the road, according to him. I mean, if someone ran you off the road, wouldn't you run out of, like, you, if you're so stunned, like, and then you're still there? Like, if so, they
unless
ran her off the road.
Butch Vance.
Unless it was, oh my God, I just talked myself into it being Butch.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I think Butch would have thrown some misdirection potentially. And maybe, I suppose you could say maybe he
maybe
did.
His misdirection was no direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing we learned early on is that typically most, not all, in all cases, but typically the people who call the police are not guilty of, you know, what they're calling the police about. It has happened, but it's not typical. And then he was also living with his common-law wife and her mom, or his mom, I think, at the time of Maura's disappearance. So then if you really do think Butch did it, you know, he would be lying about it. He would have had to have taken Maura in the blink of an eye without anyone seeing, or at least if they did see, they're too afraid of him to come forward. He takes her and does something with her without his mom and his common-law wife finding out. In like 10 minutes, because then he went out searching with the police.
Well, then he was back in his bus when when Cecil Smith came up to talk to him about the accident. So
yeah. Is it possible? I suppose, but
maybe
I think it's
he had like a random psychotic break.
Unlikely. It's so unlikely that I think you can dismiss it.
And here's a great question by a student about false information and how that could be damaging to the case.
Do you think all the information about Murray's case is making it more likely for people to come forward with false memories, opinions that complicate the investigation? Ugh, what a tough question.
Yeah.
Who had that one? Whose question was that? That was a tough question.
Good one. I think that is probably true. I mean, every lead that comes out now that doesn't solve the case can potentially be put in the category of complicating the investigation. But how are you going to know what clue doesn't, you know, actually does solve it? So, yeah, all the tips and sightings, quote unquote, and things like that happen now that go to the cold case unit, yeah, that takes up their time to investigate. Maybe not complicate the relationship or the investigation, because I think the police have a pretty good idea what they think happened.
So with what we do, we continue to talk about her case, and then other people talk about the case, and new information comes up, and new searches happen. And I agree that some of the memories and the opinions, like the memories might be something that they start to convince themselves that it happened. I think that does complicate the investigation, but it's probably pretty easy for the investigators to dismiss that, but they have to listen to it in the first place. I don't think that ultimately comes from a bad place in that person, though. I think most people want to help. I think most people see what's happening, they hear Fred, and then they say, I need to help somehow. I need to get involved, and I need to help. It's just from that point on, like, okay, so you've given your opinion on it. You've given, you know, your memory, your account of something. Then you just have to separate yourself after that. And I think the real complication comes when people can't separate themselves.
Well, also, you know, we've heard sightings or potentially false memory or opinions, like a woman in Florida was pumping gas and she looked like Maura. And, you know, we got that email and the cold case unit got that email. Well, there's nothing anyone can do about that. You know, like, she was in Florida. No one has a license plate. Okay, maybe it was Maura. It probably wasn't. Probably just looked like her. But then there's other ones, like what happened maybe a few months ago, where there was sort of a Maura lookalike, and I'll be the first to admit that, actually, at Storyland in New Hampshire. And someone took some pictures and posted that on Facebook. And it does kind of look like an older Maura, but but that one, I would say, at least is a little more actionable, because you can send those pictures to the police. You can say what day they were taken on, and they can potentially find out who that was and prove that it wasn't Maura, or was Maura.
If you want to find Maura and you can't, like, let go of these, like, attachments you have, you're going to be looking for Maura from 2004, and you're going to see her everywhere.
And here we're talking about Rick's house and the A-frame. They flashed up a couple of photographs on the projector, and they were very well aware of the work we had done up on those two properties last year and wanted to hear more about it.
The bottom house there was owned by a guy named Rick, who was not living in the house at the time. It was something he was building at the time Maura went missing, and I think it was sort of like an excavated hole, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe
there's some weird conjecture with that. Some say that there was a bit of concrete already there for the foundation, and some say that there was like it was being excavated.
Right. So yeah, a little bit of conjecture there based on neighbor reports, but so he was living in a trailer on the property, like eerily, I would say, like 100 feet from where the search dogs lost Maura's trace. Doesn't mean he did anything, but he lived right there. So he's one of the main persons that we had focused on in this investigation. And there have been countless rumors about him. And we know that the police took him seriously to a great extent, actually, in their investigation. And so we decided to bring GPR, Ground Penetrating Radar, our friends Ed and Graham, to New Hampshire. So they did the GPR over the lawn because I think there was some rumor that this guy buried her on his property right there. And we also brought cadaver dogs in who would have been able to smell that if that were true. So that came up false, you know, or in, you know, not it's not Maura, not anyone there. Same thing with the ground penetrating radar, nothing there except for a bunch of like boulders, sort of exactly where we were told there could have been a body or something.
Yeah, so he ran that ground penetrating radar. There was like the x-ray of the ground. There was some anomalies there. And we went up there a few months later or a few weeks later and to do the digging because the family who lives there now allowed us to do that and found the boulders. That was a little random, a little odd. But nothing that was highly suspicious. And Graham actually said you couldn't make this ground look more normal. So
yeah, it was their professional opinion, and they had, you know, had a lot of schooling in how to tell if ground had been disturbed or not, and so it hadn't been disturbed in 15 years.
I will say, though, that the cadaver dogs did not hit on anything on the property, but our buddy Deb, who handles the cadaver dogs, said that there was a reaction on the side of the house. She said that it could have been like trace smells of something, might be the septic or something. But she said if we were to ever go back there and do some digging, we should probably focus on the side of the house that's closest to the forest, closest to the woods.
Yeah, that you can't see here.
And I'm not saying that there's something there, but
probably
it's all part of like this like citizen detecting. Like we did this with the blessing of the police. They said, do what you got to do. The family said, go for it. The family lived there. They even allowed us to do a handheld GPR on their kitchen floor because they thought they heard something hollow. They dropped something, thought that it sounded hollow. And we basically said, I mean, their kitchen floor was one giant tile too. So it wasn't like you just pull up a tile and do a quick core.
And there's no basement too. So
and there's no basement.
Yeah, it should just be like cement under that floor.
Yeah, but that was normal. Thankfully, we didn't have to pull up there. We didn't have to make the decision to pull up their kitchen floor. But we told them that too. We said, you know what'll if we find something, you realize what's going to happen. Like, we're going to have to make a decision whether we saw a chunk of your floor out of here. And I don't know if they actually answered. I think they were just kind of waiting to see what happened.
Yeah.
But there was rumors that something was by the base of the front porch there. There was a slab of concrete that was probably 3 feet by 2.5 feet that was acting as the platform, the bottom step of the stair to go up to the porch.
Yeah.
And
it was based on a rumor. Someone said that Rick was supposed to be out of town a certain weekend and they had come by or something and saw him pouring cement there. So it's like, oh my God, well, he wasn't out of town. So that's how easily something can get from absolutely nothing to 15 years later, you're digging up
crowbarring concrete up. It's heavy, by the way.
But it was worth it, you know? And yeah, that was reinforced with actually like steel, that slab. So I think Rick did that himself.
Yeah. But to the point of this is that now it's not a rumor anymore. Now it's not anything anymore. Now, I mean, some people can still consider it. Some people can look into it, but the information's out there. There's nothing there aside from the police clearing it with their cadaver dogs and then the public clearing it through our GPR and our cadaver dogs and our digging. I don't see if there's anything more that we can do with this particular property.
Yeah, and same is kind of true for the A-frame up top there. That one at first was, I would say, location number one, like ground zero for me for a little while.
Oh,
really thought that held the answers. There's a lot of conjecture about luminol being seen, being used, and it lit up in this closet, this downstairs closet where there was a sample taken of the wall and given to the oxygen show, who tested it, and it apparently came back positive for two different people's blood. So that's pretty weird. You know, we weren't in that lab. I have no idea what happened or what, but apparently they couldn't get big enough profiles to tell who they were. One of them couldn't be ruled out as Mora. I think that was one of the main problems there. It was like ruled in to be like a woman of like Anglo-Saxon descent, but that was about where it stopped. And then we brought in cadaver dogs there too, and they sniffed in the closet and didn't even, like, the only thing they were interested in that house was the dog toys.
And you run a danger, not dangerous, but you run a fine line when you talk about the A-frame. There's misinformation out there that cadaver dogs went in there at one time, and the cadaver dogs went to this closet and went bonkers. When cadaver dogs smell a cadaver, when they smell human remains, they don't go bonkers. They actually do the exact opposite. They sit down. So that information was out there forever. And everyone was like, there's something in the closet. The dogs went bonkers. Well, the dogs went bonkers because they probably smelled like some food that was cooked or something. Like, they did not smell human remains there. The blood being in there is not suggestive that there was at all enough blood to think that someone died there due to blood loss. The luminol lit up, yes, and there was blood found, yes, but those are two separate things. Luminol can light up not just with blood. It can light up with bleach.
Yeah.
And we did, we took core samples from the concrete right down in there, like deep, down to like almost a foot.
Inside the closet.
Inside the closet where the luminol was supposedly lighting up. And concrete is incredibly porous. And after, if there was that much blood where someone had bled there, where it would have lit up, you would have seen dark staining. It was as clean as concrete could be. So I think we can effectively write that off. And then the big mysterious concrete slab that's in the A-frame front yard. Yeah, it's super weird. It's weird the way it's positioned. It's weird the way it was poured. It's reinforced in weird ways because usually concrete's reinforced in like a grid. This was just reinforced on the perimeter, and then there was nothing in the middle. And they had these like weird bored out holes that looked like a footprint of something. And while it's weird, it's still more suggestive that someone had maybe a hunting tower on that property in New Hampshire, or a fire tower, or maybe a swing set. It's definitely not like we're going to pull that up and there's a kill room down there. It's probably someone had a hunting tower there.
And they ran GPR over it too, and so there was nothing.
Numerous times.
Yeah, there was nothing going on over there.
And samples were taken. And I think there was a question in the last class, which I thought was interesting. What do you do after you, like as a citizen, what do you do after you go into someone's house and you just start drilling into their floor and you take all this stuff out? What you have to do is just always plan for the other part of the thing. We had GB Geotechnics, amazing people. They did the sample extraction, and then they refilled it, and it looks better than it did before. So if you're ever in the situation where you got to do that, make sure you have the back end of it where you're going to leave it looking better than it did before.
And just to answer the questions there, was the person who owned the house ever questioned, and why did they not let the police search the property? The second one is unanswerable, I guess, because we don't really know why he didn't let the police search his property. But he was apparently very angry about it, did not want the police on his property. And yes, he was questioned. His some people very close to him were questioned as well. Actually, the house was searched by police the day he sold it.
I'm talking about the bottom one.
And Rick, the trailer that he owned and lived in at the time of Mora's disappearance was pulled over and searched as soon as it was sold and towed off of his property. So I think that gives you a pretty good indication where the police's heads were at with that particular suspect.
Yeah, the current owners of the house said the day that they signed on the house and moved in, that night they got a knock on the door from the police to go in there and search. So they were sort of perched there waiting.
But, you know, Lance and I talked in the class that met before you guys about how, you know, it's not necessarily something nefarious, meaning that a private citizen won't let law enforcement search their property, right? Especially up here in New Hampshire, you guys are live free or die people. And especially in rural and remote areas, right? There are a lot of folks who are just, this is just not in their, you know, mind frame to have law enforcement on their property. And it might not be for any other reason other than they just don't want it.
That's right? True. Yeah. Thank you for adding that. Yeah. I think it's a little bit of a cultural thing with people in the White Mountain area specifically. And background checks.
You go there for a reason.
Yeah. Background checks for the neighbors. The bus driver, I believe, was clean. I don't think he had any. I think there was, like, something where he, like, lied about being a police officer at one point in his past where he wasn't, which
Who
is kind of
Who hasn't lied about being a cop?
I definitely have not. Should not lie about being a cop. But I think his background is pretty clean. There's been some other people. Actually, some of the people down the road definitely do.
I would say that everybody who has a background, some sort of criminal background, has been followed up on in connection with Morris' case. I would feel very comfortable making that assumption.
Well, and it seems like there's a finite pool of people, right? Because the area is
anybody who has a criminal background has probably been interviewed about Morris' case.
How about phone calls? So I got a few questions about phone calls, but this was the general kind of question from students. What is the connection, if any, between the phone card and the voicemail left on the boyfriend's phone? I never heard of anything about the phone card before. Is that a detail that pops up a lot in the?
It's super weird.
Yeah.
It's really hard to make sense of it. And stop me if I'm incorrect on any of this.
All of it.
It gets kind of fuzzy sometimes. So the phone card is a card that's issued by the Red Cross. And Bill Rausch, her boyfriend at the time, was at Fort Sill in Oklahoma.
So the Red Cross gives those calling cards to someone like Bill,
yes,
who will then distribute them to the cadets to call their family and friends.
Yeah, so it comes from like a pack of cards. And the call that we're talking about is the one that he received while he was going through security at the airport on his way back to New Hampshire to help search for Maura. He gets a call as he's going through security, and it's actually kind of heartbreaking when you look through that. You can see where he's calling and receiving calls, and it's like Fred, Maura's roommate, Maura's friend, Fred, and then there's a period of like maybe 15 minutes or something where it's like obvious he's going through security. And then it's like this call comes in, then voicemail, Fred. So you can just play out what happened. He got this voicemail, and then he's like checking it and calling Fred. I don't think that he really has an answer other than I guess it's what they told me it was, which was a bad connection from somebody at the Red Cross who was calling him because he had taken leave. And I guess it's the Red Cross's obligation to check up on their cadets when they take like bereavement leave or emergency leave.
I think they even make travel plans for them or help them with it at times.
Yeah.
So I think that's what was happening when they called. He was apparently, Bill, that is, was apparently at the airport with his phone off going through security when that phone call came through. So that's why there's no number, I don't think. There's not like a missed call number. It was just a voicemail that he got that seemed pretty ominous to him.
But to like the what really makes this an interesting detail is that Maura, I think, probably did have one of the cards that was issued. The coincidence is that the call came from the Red Cross. So
why would they need a calling card?
Exactly. So it's, did they call from their own calling card? Like, it's very
confusing.
Strange. And then it's like, well, Bill said that he heard a female sobbing. I mean, it's a bad connection, but maybe he was just wishfully thinking that Maura had called him, and that's what he wanted to hear.
Well, he was pretty sure at the time. If you watch the video, I think it's on the Disappeared episode, where he talks about that sound that he heard in that voicemail, and he's dead convinced in that clip. I think in the years since, that's changed, though.
And the factors going into why that's changed, who knows? You know, maybe he has talked himself into, you know, she didn't call me. That could be just a defense mechanism, a way to deal with what if she did call him. And, you know, what if she did? Maybe she did call him. Maybe she was in trouble and got to a phone and didn't have time to fully make that call.
Yeah. Yeah, I think his phone activity is certainly different on, you know, around the time when Maura went missing. His average phone calls went from like 5 a day to like 50. So, but it's probably a, you know, a guy under immense stress because his girlfriend went missing.
And he was never a suspect anyway because of the distance involved.
Yeah, not really, I don't think, yeah.
Not by law enforcement.
And here we start talking about Alden Olsen, Lance, your favorite topic.
Well, you know I love talking about that. You know that that's my favorite thing to bring up in the early stages when we're doing anything in the public. Yeah, unfortunately, it's one of those things that happened with this case that was important. And it was significant, and people have questions about it because you can't put something out there that's that creepy and not have people say, well, that guy had something to do with Maura's disappearance. So that just comes with the inevitable questions. Plus, the story is really interesting. And even though I say in jest that I love doing it to make you think that I don't love doing it, I actually do love talking about this.
Of course, the YouTube videos. If you want to, I don't know how you guys want to handle that. It seems like we could talk for 10 hours about this in particular. Yeah. Lance gave kind of a good summary of who this guy is. And yes, he's been identified. You know his name, right?
Yeah.
But if you could talk about maybe just like recap that. Why did the police decide, or if you know, why did the police decide that he wasn't a suspect? And anything about the other things that he posted, like the map and the face and all that.
So apparently he was a suspect in Maura Murray's disappearance before this video came out, which was something we hadn't known the whole time. And so I think he made this video as a reaction to being a suspect, and I guess what he believes, he's taunting the police, the family, everyone out there. I don't know why the police decided he wasn't a suspect, but again, apparently... that happened before this video was released.
In the video that we watched together in class, I don't think that they mentioned the top photo, the map.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you guys explain that?
Sure.
The legend of Alden Olsen starts with the ski pass that he posted on YouTube, and it's just a slow zoom into the Bretton Woods ski pass, cross-country ski pass, and it goes to the date, and the date was the 9th or something, but it was to indicate, the video was titled Maura Murray, and it was to indicate that Maura Murray went to Bretton Woods with somebody else, and the ski pass was her ski pass, and it zooms into the date, which he later says in one of his posts that he had photoshopped that. It does look like it's photoshopped after someone says, yeah, that's where I photoshopped it. Once you look at it, you go, oh, okay, I can see where the date was changed. So that's where the legend starts. And then he posted the one where he's laughing. That's the happy anniversary video.
Definitely one of the creepiest things you'll find on the internet.
One of the creepiest things. Not so, like the demeanor, his laughing, his cackling, the background, the lighting, it's all the music. Academy Award for set design there.
Yeah.
And then he went through this series of other videos that came out that completely consumed everybody, myself included, and I hate myself because of it, for like 3 months. It was like maybe twice a week, once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks, but you could guarantee that you'd find something from Alden, on a regular basis.
Yeah, he still writes blogs, I think, now, which is really weird because his writing is actually kind of really good.
I was saying that before. I was like, if you want to see, I mean, his writing's good. His blog is Passing Through Town.
Yeah, he's got a few now.
Hemingway.
But up here where the numbers are, that's actually, you could actually like lay that on top of the Bretton Woods ski resort map. And so I think there's like 27 points or maybe more on that map. But 1, 5, 27, and 8 were the corners of that map. So he was apparently trying to tell people about Bretton Woods in some cryptic way that probably means absolutely nothing.
And this clip, we discuss the fish and game searches, Todd Bogardus and some other searches done in the recent days after Maura went missing.
And I think it kind of goes back to the Occam's razor point I think a lot of people will say Occam's razor leads you to believe that she's in that immediate vicinity somewhere in those woods, right like in a mile range from where her car was found. There were a lot of searches done immediately in that area. Helicopters, infrared, fish and game. My boy Todd Bogardus.
Love him.
Has been on like hundreds of searches, and there's only two people I think he didn't find, and Maura was one of them.
Yeah.
So he's a real professional dude, and they did a few, yeah, right after she went missing. So I personally don't believe she's right there in those woods.
Yeah.
I can see why some people think that that is the most likely outcome, though.
In the words of Rick Graves, who worked with the family, he was a citizen who worked with the family on the search. He had a long history of searching for downed aircraft. That was his hobby. He would travel around and locate airplanes that had crashed. And so he was familiar with, like, beating through woods. He said that the time that he spent with the family going up there every weekend, he said, we beat the hell out of those woods.
Yeah.
And those woods are, I mean, there's some areas that are thin, but there are some areas that are incredibly dense. And they went in as deep as they could.
And to him
find
and Fred.
Nothing. Yeah, him and Fred, to find nothing. Like, not even an article of clothing. Not even a cell phone. Like, there was absolutely nothing. So
yeah, and those are just those guys, you know, Fred being Mara's dad and Rick being a volunteer who had some history of searching for missing things. And so why were they not successful? I don't know. I mean,
I guess they weren't.
Either
I guess
she's not there or they weren't looking in the right place.
Yeah, I think they were not successful. I think they were successful in determining that she is not there. They need to look somewhere else. They need to expand the search radius, and then they expand it, and she's not there. So they expand it again, and now I think they're not successful because I think somebody probably took her very far away and disposed of her body pretty effectively.
But there are searches that happen, I think, twice a year. There's a group of citizen detectives who call themselves Boots on the Ground who will meet up there and search. And I think it's like a group of like maybe like 30 people or something like that. And they are as organized as they can be. And so I think they hit a lot of areas and they'll hit areas of rumor and things like that.
I think a lot of why they go up there is being a citizen is important to note that part of them wants to find something, but I think a bigger part of them wants to show everybody in the area that this is not going away. They'll keep going in there and they'll keep going into the woods because the person who probably did this is probably very familiar with that area and someone knows that person because you don't just happen upon that area and happen to find this young woman and do something bad. You know, like that person, as far as all of the people that we've spoken to, experts, profilers, that person is either from that area or has a home there and is familiar with that area. So these boots on the ground searches go towards the pressure just to maintain on the people up there. You know, they might know somebody who knows something.
And how soon after the disappearance did the police search? I think that was like a few days. I think I want to say that was 3 days. And I think there was some snow that actually fell on Monday, the day she went missing. And there wasn't any snow after that before they searched. So in theory, they would have seen footprints running through the woods or through the snow if Mora had gone that way.
I think large predators, scavengers, you can take that into account. I don't know. I'm pretty sure bears are still hibernating in February. I'm not trying to be like sarcastic about that, but people say like a hungry bear, you know, maybe if you woke it up out of hibernation, it would do something. Usually bears in that area, they're not killer bears. They will probably walk away from you unless they're like starving coming out of hibernation, but it's still like the middle of winter.
So you guys definitely have opportunistic scavengers in the woods up here, for sure. But she disappears with what, a cell phone, a backpack, something,
wallet,
like,
keys.
Some stuff with her, right? So to never find that on top of never finding remains is like that's the totality of like nothing.
You think you'd find something like white snow, like people bleed?
Yeah. I don't know a whole lot about the case, but I mean, as far as bears go, like you'd find remains if like they don't completely consume something. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
You'd find remains.
Yeah. You'd find bone. I mean, especially like that soon after. I could see if we went in there now for the first time, being like, oh, where is everything? You know, because a lot happens. But like a week in.
And now they ask for some, I guess, personal speculation. They asked for our theories, and so we gave what we feel at this point.
Yeah, this is important because we never gave any theories in the past. We spent the majority of this, this show saying that we don't have a particular theory. It goes from one day to the next. It's a different scenario that is in our heads. But recently, because of the people we've worked with, because of the work that's been done on it, the interviews and all of the information gathering, I think you and I have been led down a path where we can triangulate what we think the most likely outcome is. And it's not just you and I putting that together based on some blog posts and some, you know, Wikipedia research. Like, this is a combination of 3, 4, 5 years of talking to people and going to the location and talking to law enforcement. So I think that's a good example of what you can do if you have your own cold case you're working on, how to approach it, and then how to hone down your theory.
We've talked about a lot of this. Cadaver dogs, could somebody have picked her up after the crash? Maybe a good thing to end on is, if you want to, can you give us your kind of speculations on what you think happened?
Sure.
Your personal takes, and yeah. Do they differ?
Yeah, I don't think they differ too much. But I mean, I think
tree to tree.
I think she willingly got into a car after her crash. Yeah, and she was taken somewhere. Maybe just dropped off by a good Samaritan who never was familiar with the coverage and didn't know that he dropped her off and something happened to her there. But what I think is more likely is that she willingly got into a car of someone who did something bad to her.
I will add to that, somebody who is from the area or knows the area really well, maybe has a vacation house or lodge, like goes there to ski or to hike in the summer, maybe to hunt.
Yeah.
But somebody who would be put there, which is a good 20 minutes off the highways.
Yeah. 15, 20. Yeah.
Yeah. In the winter, like I said, like in February, like that is a pretty like direct route from point A to point B if you're going to cross. But that time of night, Monday night, yeah. In the winter, you know why you like you're there. You don't just happen to be there unless you're Mora. You don't just happen to be like, oh, I'm just on Route 112 up here.
Yeah.
Right.
One other thing the police did was, I think the next Monday night at that same time, they set up a roadblock right there and stopped every single car that drove by, wrote their names down, where they were going and why. So I think the person whose car Mora got in is probably on that list.
Yeah, I would agree.
So do you think it's opportunistic that person was in that area? Okay. So it's not calculated in a way of like planned. It's just this was an opportunistic.
That's my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. And real quick anecdote. You just always learn when you look into this case. You learn just stuff about the way you think about it and the way you try to like put the pieces together. I kept thinking about Mora being abducted and then taken away and maybe like put in a closet or put in a basement or, you know, like tortured or something. And then we went up there for one of our searches, and I tell Tim the story all the time. He's probably sick of it.
I hate it.
We went up there for one of our searches, and we were staying at an Airbnb, and it was one of those like complexes where it was a bunch of like townhouses. And I took the trash out the next morning and I drove down to where we dropped the trash off, and it was a giant trash compactor that's like this size from here to there. And I put the trash in, and there's the button that like crushes everything, and it warns you not to do that. But I looked at it and it just hit me. I was thinking, if someone took Mora, killed her, cut her up and put her in this trash compactor, no one would ever find her.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I think to that point, I think if someone did do that and put Mora in a trash compactor, that person knew the area. If she was met with foul play, I think the person probably knows the area pretty well, probably put her in an area he knew someone wouldn't go or be traipsing through regularly, whether that's that person's property or somewhere else, I don't know.
Point being, just keep your brain open to all of the possibilities, because someone did something successful. This is a...
Yeah, that's the point. Yeah.
It's so successful, there's been no trace of anything. Not even a single credible sighting after.